All right, welcome back to Church and State, everybody. My name is Stephen Cox, your host. And if you've been paying attention at all to the past couple of years and debates about religious freedom and liberalism, you'll recognize that there's basically been an emergence of thought about liberalism in totality. On the one hand, you have folks like Professor Patrick Deneen of Notre Dame, and basically calling into question and having some skepticism towards the liberal project. You have, on the other hand, Catholics who are like George Weigel, these conservatives who've long ago embraced the liberal project. And then in the past couple years, we've seen an emergence of what I guess we could call integral Catholics or illiberal Catholics trying to correct where these radicals and where these conservatives are going wrong. And in the past year or two, there's been a kind of a flare-up of this on the pages of various publications between authors like John Lamont, Thomas Pink, and others trying to reconcile the Second Vatican Council's teaching on religious liberty to previous teachings. And to discuss that, as well as some other issues, I've invited on Dr. Brian McCall, professor in law at Oklahoma Law School, who's presented at various conferences, Catholic Family News conferences. He's the author of several books, including The Church and the Usurers from Catholic University of America Press, as well as the highly recommended To Build the City of God, Living as Catholics in a Secular Age from Angelico Press. Welcome to Church and State, Dr. McCall.
Thank you.
We appreciate you being on. And I guess first things first, you know, well, let's get into the heart of what I wanted to chat about today. And that's the church's teaching on not just church-state relations, but also this idea of religious liberty, because they are different concepts. You know, I was reading an article the other day by Cardinal Avery Dulles, and, you know, it's a very influential cardinal within the past, in the 20th century. And, you know, the argument is always the same, that there was a slow progressive development on religious liberty within the church, starting with Pius IX in the 19th century through Leo XIII, then ultimately with Pius XII, and culminating in, obviously, the Second Vatican Council on the dignity of the human person. And, you know, I think in many ways, the argument is, well, at least traditionalists respond to that by saying, well, no, the dignity of the human person does not allow for religious liberty. You know, the state cannot be incompetent on religious matters. So before we get into, you know, Professor Pink's thesis and John Lamont's perhaps response and your views, set right this record of what the church's traditional teaching is on these two very important issues that seemingly the church in our time has completely jettisoned and brushed aside.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to start, this idea, there's been this gradual development from Pius IX through Digitatis Humanae and current magisterium is just, the facts don't bear that out. I mean, whatever your position is, whatever you're saying, I mean, the facts is there is a break, a dramatic change, really, with that it manifests itself in the Second Vatican Council. Obviously, it was bubbling up before that, but not in official teaching, in dissent from official teaching. And again, interesting, there's a really fascinating book by a gentleman at, I think he was at Georgetown at least when he wrote the book, Dr. Shook, that he goes through every papal encyclical from the beginning through wherever, I think, Caritas in Veritate,
sure,
by the last one. And again, he's not a traditionalist. He's not at all. He's just sort of a scholar kind of documenting things. And he sort of says, well, they kind of fall into these different buckets. There's this first period, really up to Leo XIII, and there's Leo XIII, Pius XII, and then Pius XII on. And he just says sort of historically, the first two periods are related and are just sort of refinements and developments one to the other. The third is just completely different. Mm-hmm. I think from what he says, he kind of likes the difference and says this is, you know, really, it's a good thing. But he kind of admits this is totally different and there's no basis in what was coming before. I mean, Digitatis Humanae does not cite any of this prior teaching as support for its propositions. Mm-hmm. And just in and of itself, that shows we have a change in that. And the change is really, again, it's very difficult because there's certain, and Lamont is good about, I think, pointing this out, there are certain phrases and words which exist in tradition, mm-hmm. but which are given different meanings. And this dignity of the human person is a good example from what you say, where they sort of repeat a phrase but mean something very, very different.
Right. I think that's where the Archbishop Lefebvre goes into in his books. There's differences in dignity. There's the operative and there's the ontological. Could you get into some of his thoughts and where he kind of pointed out the flaws in the Second Vatican Council, if you're able to do that at all?
I mean, on that specific point, I can't say it as well as the Archbishop, but I'll try to summarize.
Sure.
I mean, essentially, yeah, I mean, there is a certain natural dignity to every person by virtue of the constituents of their human nature. So the having a body and soul united gives a certain dignity above a pure animal nature, for example. But that's just merely a natural place that we fall within a hierarchy of being.
With the intellect and the will, right? It's a gift we have, right?
By having these, by being given these gifts. But what's important about that is that dignity can be lost or can be harmed by our actions. We can misuse it. So we can have something that has a dignity to it, but if we put it to an improper use, we lose that dignity. And the greatest example of that is the fall.
Right.
And that's why the prayer, the traditional mass at the offertory, I think one of those beautiful prayers, and the priest blesses the water, reminds us that God endowed human race with a certain dignity and ennobled it by the redemption. He brought it back and gave the possibility of restoring it. So whereas the sort of more modern concept is sort of this inalienable dignity, no matter what you do, this exists, is sort of overlooking the fact that we can misuse that dignity, and when we do, we have, we have harmed it in a certain way.
And I think that's the heart of the traditional distinction is, well, look, in the name of human dignity, you can't have a right, so to speak, to adhere to what is objectively false, right? Your erroneous conscience does not grant you, as I think Father Connell and Father Shea argued, an objective right to adhere to that which ultimately the Catholic Church's traditional teaching has always said, if you adhere to error and you live by that life, well, you need to be Catholic if you want to get into heaven, right? I mean, you got to adhere to what is objectively true. And Leo points that out. He says the true dignity of the person protects our authentic freedom. So perhaps that's, the view of the Church's teachings on religious liberty, so to speak. What about church-state relations? Because this argument that's been coming up in the past couple of years, and that happened at Vatican II, was that the church, or the state rather, is incompetent, and that by its natural rights, it doesn't have the authority to coerce or restrict non-Catholic cults from promulgating their views in public. What is the church's traditional teaching? And then kind of we'll get gently into where this new debate is going that Professor Pink gets into, that the state cannot have this right, or that the church doesn't have this policy that it wants to enact.
And in my view, I think part of the confusion over this issue is again, confusion of terms and confusion of concepts. And we have a very distorted notion, particularly, and that's why I hate to use the word the state. I mean, we have to use it as a part of our parlance.
Sure.
But it now, at least, it brings up this idea of the state as some abstract entity of its own, right? That is just this all-encompassing totalitarian
thing. We look at it through a liberal lens,
And we sort of accepted that vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what the church always talked about is not so much that, but that it always sort of focused on there are people, right? And we sort of, everything's first of all focused on people. And people have two natures. They have a natural sort of nature and a natural end, but they're also, because they've been created by God, have a supernatural aspect of their nature infused through baptism, and that leads to a supernatural end. But those two things are in the same person. They are as inseparable as body and soul. So we although we can talk about them distinctly and say, well, right now I'm actually primarily referring to the natural aspect of man, and here I'm primarily referring to the supernatural. You can never divide them because mm-hmm. they're part of the same person.
Right.
It's kind of like if you had two physicians who are trying to heal somebody of complicated diseases, and one of them is a kidney specialist and one's a heart specialist, and the one saying, well, I'm kind of focusing on the kidney right now, they can't ignore this kidney's part of a whole being.
Sure.
They're so aware of that, I have to prescribe their treatment in light of it.
Yes, yes.
And in light of that, the church says, well, there are two authorities that two powers to enact laws and rules to guide men towards their end, natural and supernatural. One of them we call the civil or the temporal or the secular. I'm using those synonyms.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And the other we call the ecclesiastical. And so they are two different groups of people, two distinguished hierarchies of people, which are invited to participate in God's lawmaking authority by making more specific rules that aid men in going towards their end. And although we can distinguish between these two, just like the two different doctors distinguish the two body parts, they're never separate. We can never wholly separate them. So if the kidney doctor says, well, I'm just going to take the kidney out and operate on it and take outside the body and work on it and make it the greatest kidney ever, it'd be pointless because the person would die, right? As this is what Leo XIII says, he says the separation of church and state, in the sense of these are wholly separate, unconnected, is the result of that is death, because right. You can't separate them.
Separation of soul and body, I think.
Body, right. Exactly. Yeah. The two powers, the two lawmaking authorities, are distinct, have distinct realms of operation, but they operate on the same subject. Again, that medical analogy is helpful. They're both working on the same subject, and so there must be some coordination, some relationship, although there are distinctions in between their tasks and how they pursue the same common end of the good of the unified person. I don't know if that...
Yeah, absolutely.
In a short time.
Sure. And I think, you know, we see that shift away from that argumentation, or that doctrine, rather, in John Courtney Murray, who, again, in the 1950s is writing and saying, the state knows nothing about the true religion. It's incompetent.
The state. Well, who is the state? It's people. Right? Mm-hmm. So when we talk about the state, or really, more accurately, the civil authority, it's people who occupy offices. Well, those people have a human nature, and we know, St. Thomas teaches, that even on the natural level, we do have the ability to know the true religion. Mm-hmm. We can't know all supernatural truths without divine assistance of faith, but our nature is capable, when we hear the truth, of knowing the true religion. We can come to a knowledge of the true religion. So if any individual can do that, the people who occupy the offices of civil authority have the same ability. Uh-huh. So this idea of Mary, well, the state is somehow incompetent, because he doesn't really understand that we're just talking about people.
Right.
And people, all people, unless he denies that truth of faith, all people have the ability to know the true religion. When presented with it, the state is obviously competent, just like all of us are.
So two things then, because there's this clip. I'm not sure if you've seen it. It's George Weigel on EWTN a couple years ago. It's titled "Weigel's Mocking the Social Kingship of Christ." His argument, and I think Murray's was too, that if the state can declare someone king, or if the state can recognize the one true religion, it can declare anyone king, or can declare any religion. And what do you make of that sort of thinking?
Again, we got to be careful with words. And Leo XIII is great with this in Libertas. What do you mean by can? Right. The state. I mean, is it physically possible? Could this happen? Well, God created us with free will, so anyone has the physical ability to do anything like that. Anybody that becomes president could send the army to go kill a bunch of people. Mm-hmm. But do we mean can in the sense of, do they have the moral liberty to do that? Mm. Is it consistent with the cosmological law of the universe? Is it consistent with natural law? Are they able to do that and retain the dignity of the office in which they have?
Sure.
And the answer to his question is, well, no, they can't just go around proclaiming anybody king, or that, because they can only proclaim he who has a right to it.
Right. Adhering to truth.
So they have the physical ability to be derelict in their duty and do something contrary to
them. Right. I hear a response to that oftentimes as well. One can acknowledge and adhere to truth without necessarily proclaiming that which is erroneous. I think that's, you know, perhaps a good way to think about it too, because the state can adhere and recognize to the gravitational fact of gravity and the law of gravity, but it doesn't mean if it does that, it could somehow change the law of gravity. And it's a sloppy reasoning, but I think, you know, if it can, like, I think we move into now, should it? And that's, I think, the thrust of recent debates. Thomas Pink, John Lamont, is should the state? And the Second Vatican Council, according to Pink, is that, well, the church changed a policy towards coercing, or towards having states coerce on its behalf. And in that time period and since then, the church has said it's better to not coerce on our behalf, and that the church or the state, again, the state, we want to be careful of their terms, but that mm-hmm. persons in office should not or do not have the ability to recognize by its own natural lights what the true religion is. Get us into Pink's thoughts on this. And
And again, couple distinctions. I mean, the people still absolutely have the ability, not that they will live up to it or be able to, but the ability to recognize the true religion, definitely. However, where there's a matter of when anyone has political office, there's always a matter of prudence. In a certain circumstance, what particular action should be done? And as St. Thomas clearly says, for example, human law cannot, and in fact, you know, should not prohibit everything that's wrong. Everything is against the natural law, because as a matter of prudence, that may be too much, it may be too fast, it may cause people to misunderstand it. So there's lots of reasons for prudence why civil lawmakers might restrain from doing something they have a right absolutely to do. So they could do it, and there's certainly, the church could certainly change prudentially and say, our advice to the civil authorities is you maybe shouldn't be enacting these laws right now for some practical, prudential political reasons.
Higher good.
But that's a higher good. But that's, there's two very important qualifications on it. Number one, the civil authority can never do the opposite. It can tolerate, because we're not going to actually enact laws stopping this, mm-hmm. but it can never actually promote what's wrong. So, again, switch to another context for an example. The civil authority might not be in a position where prescribing something like abortion by punishing it criminally, prudentially can't get it done. But can never promote it. Can never say, well, it's a good, you should go do it. May say, we can't actually enforce this right now. There's so many of them out there, prudentially, we can't arrest everybody. It's a matter of prudence. But you can never say, well, you actually have a right to do it. Mm-hmm. They just say, well, we're actually not enforcing this law right now.
Right.
That's the first kind of aspect of that. The second is, it doesn't mean that they're not competent to do it. If in different prudential circumstances, the state, you know, could say, okay, well, things are different. These laws, you know, or these particular laws could be enacted. The other problem with Pink's analysis is that I think a lot of things he says are good. He isn't just saying there's a prudential change of that magnitude. He actually creates a theory of church-state relations that is not in the tradition. It's not in what Leo XIII, Pius IX, Pius X say. His theory in a nutshell, and I'm not going to do a complete justice, but essentially is the civil authority only has the authority to enact laws supporting the establishment of the true religion if deputized by the church.
Yes.
So it's kind of a chain of command argument. Mm-hmm. The church has the authority to do it, which he doesn't dispute. He says, but the civil authority has no independent authority unless the church says, go do this.
Right.
And prior to Digitatis Humani, he says, the church used to say, go do this. Now it says, don't. Once the church withdraws that, then the civil authority has no authority of its own. And that's not at all what Leo XIII taught. He actually says that because the civil authority has the aim of the good of man, which is both natural and supernatural, its primary focus and its realm of operation is the natural good. But it can't ignore the supernatural good, and it has the ability, as Pius XI says, to recognize the true religion. The civil authority actually has an independent right in and of itself to promote or have laws that promote or establish the true religion. It doesn't derive that authority from the church. Mm. Now, it has no right in matters of theological doctrine to say, well, this is what the church should teach, but it has the right to enforce or to make part of civil law those determinations of the church. That distinction is correct. But it has an independent authority to prescribe acts against the natural law. Uh-huh. And false worship is against the natural law. Uh-huh. So that's where he kind of invents something that Leo XIII or Pius XI wouldn't accept as a premise to the rest of his argument. Even though they would agree that the church could advise the state, hey, prudentially, you shouldn't use the power that you have right now. We think it's just because of the mess out there, not a good thing to be doing right now. We should focus our attention on other things.
Okay, so even, and let's assume his theory is there's some truth in that, because when I hear it, and the idea, is that the church has a practical or has a prudential decision to tell the state. I mean, I go back and say, well, okay, what sort of reasons were given at the Second Vatican Council that would have legitimized this? And, you know, when you go and read John Courtney Murray and you go and read, you know, there's a book out there called 12 Council Fathers, I think. The argument was that, well, in like the United States and other Western countries, we are not trusted by non-Catholics. There's much skepticism. And some of the other arguments that came out after the Second Vatican Council, I think it was John Paul II who told Archbishop Lefebvre that, hey, you know, religious freedom is helping us in these Eastern Bloc countries. And I wonder, even if some of the reasons that they give to back up Pink's thesis, if those cannot still be called into question, because Murray's argument, which I think we've seen is, has been proven, you know, incapable of in bringing about the results that it wanted. And the United States is much more secular than it's ever been. All the Western countries are. And his argument, really, when you read it, seems to me just to be someone who doesn't want to be tried in the fires and temptations at the times he's been put in. He wants to kind of draw down the sword, focus on fighting secularism, and trying to buddy up with non-Catholics. And I wonder, even if Pink's thesis is there is some truth to it, I would even challenge further and say, well, what about those reasons that the church has given? Can the state or can the church act in a way that eventually undercuts the state?
You're right. There's sort of two critiques out of them. One is, and this is actually what the pre-conciliar pope said, Leo XIII, Pius X, Pius XI, they sort of said this liberal Catholic idea, which is summed up in a free church and a free state.
Right.
So kind of, this is better for us. They actually say practically doesn't, ultimately doesn't work. Like, it might buy you some time a little bit. It might be helpful in some sort of a little bit, but ultimately it's not good for the state. Even the civil authority, it's not good for. Because when you sort of embed in law something contrary and embed a principle that's untrue, it's going to lead to dissolution. So there's sort of that first practical argument. But again, I think the deeper problem is that it's one thing, and this is not what the council did, not what happened after. If they just said, prudentially, we're making a declaration, we're not in a position to do this right now, this is prudentially not good, and here's the advice we give Catholic states, that you should tolerate some things that we wouldn't have tolerated before just because of the really, it might have said, it ended up bad, it was a mistake, let's change it. You know, the prudential decision we made didn't work out. But the deeper problem is in doing that, when you don't just say this is a prudential decision, you say the civil authority has no power because of this, quote, dignity of man issue to restrain a person in public or in private from exercising any religion they choose, even if it's wrong. Then you actually don't just say a prudential statement, you embed it in a principle, and the principle is wrong. And so, again, that's much of more of the harm that's come out of it is – more than we just made this really bad prudential judgment that turned out badly for us, which would be bad. But it's even worse when you do it in the name of a principle that says, because you can never, you might have a civil right to do something wrong in the mere negative sense that the government won't stop you or punish you. But that can never be translated to a natural right connected with the nature of man. And that's what a statement like, in public and private, there's no competency of the civil authority to restrain you from doing that. That now turns in more from just as a matter of civil law, you can't be punished for this, to you have a positive natural right to do it, which is, you know, a false principle.
And we've seen the past, you know, 50, 60 years in states, there was just statistics the other day in Italy, 50% of people there are Catholics now. Ireland just allowed for, I think it was abortion or same-sex unions to be legalized. Colombia, all these formerly Catholic states, Spain, they've all gone by the wayside. And, you know, the one response you hear a lot from folks who perhaps, let's say, are just opposed to what our views are, they say, well, confessional states, you know, those always corrupted people. It gave too much power to the civil authority. They always point to, like, certain states like Franco's Spain and other places, but they never point to, who was it, like, Garcia Moreno or, you know, or, like, authentically, or Dollfuss in the 1930s. I think it was Austria. You know, there are certain arguments they use against us to say, well, it wouldn't work ever in a confessional state. But I mean, they're standing on twigs and on straw. I mean, this free church in a free state has not worked out. You know, that's what even folks, I think it was Weigel, who in a First Things article a couple years ago said, hey, this Catholic moment's never arrived. And I was thinking, well, it's never going to. Your principles are out of line.
Well, I mean, actually, ironic. I mean, a Catholic confessional state provides much more protection against totalitarianism than secularism. I mean, just as a matter of principle, as a matter of fact, because what secularism says is there's a monolithic power. There is only the, quote, state, this modern invention of this monolith that has a monopoly on all power. Mm-hmm. Churches, all the others, all private associations, you can express your views, but they have no authority. The law is legal positivism, whatever we say it is. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Catholic confessional state was much, much more complicated. And interestingly, even though he's not Catholic, the work of Harold Berman, a legal historian, is great on the Middle Ages, is fascinating. And he says, medieval, during the Age of Faith, rulers were so much more constrained in what they could do because there were these multiple sources of legal power and political power. Because it was a confessional state, they were restrained by principles of natural law, by the authority of the papacy. Say, you can't do that. That law has no force. You've gone beyond. You cannot oppress the people this way. So you had these checks. You know, we kind of in American constitutional talk about checks and balances, but it's all within this little box. It's like these little checks and balances, but there's no actual check on the system itself.
Right. Great point.
And so ironically, a system that talks about checks and balances on power so much has a totally unchecked system. I mean, if we just amend the Constitution, we can do whatever we want, right? In a confessional state, there are parameters to the would narrowly defined because of this distinction that the civil authority is obligated to listen to the church and listen to, as the guardian of the natural and divine law, say, this is beyond your jurisdiction. You may want to do this, but you can't. It's actually a greater protection, I would argue, for everyone, but even particularly for minorities, because for people that actually are being, that are not part of, if it were a Catholic confessional state, who are out of that, because the church says, under the natural law, there are certain things you can't do to people, no matter, you know, what they are, even if they're wrong. They're wrong about these things. You can't do that to them. And the church, you know, is actually the one that stood up. Again, some human failings, didn't always succeed, but actually could speak with authority against a civil authority out of control looking to dominate. But in this vacuum created by the Enlightenment Project, you have this all-powerful state that has no check. Because if there's no, everybody can have their own morality, everybody can have their own religion, there's nothing that stands between us and a totalitarian state.
So we're running a bit short on time. If there's anyone out there perhaps still convinced or still thinks, you know, Pink's thesis is right, or, you know, that the traditional position is wrong and maybe incorrect, what else would you say to them with some any closing thoughts on maybe anything we haven't covered yet today or anything else in his ideas that you'd want to point out?
I mean, again, I think he has a very noble sentiment, Dr. Pink. I think he recognizes a lot of the stuff that's being said in the church today is wrong, and he wants to try to correct that. He also recognizes it's very important that, you know, the church has official, that the magisterium of the church cannot contradict itself. Unfortunately, he kind of just wants to twist things to fit them together so he can prove that everything's okay, rather than just saying, look, this doesn't fit. There's a rupture here, and we have to make a choice. They're not compatible. Mm-hmm. He wants to create a whole theory of church and state that's incompatible with the whole teaching underlying the preconciliar popes, so you can reconcile statements. And so we can make these statements fit together, which, you know, I understand. It's we live in horrible times, and I understand that it's a noble desire.
Sure.
But, you know, Our Lady, our Saint John, stood at the cross, and we need to reconcile this with him being God. And, you know, you don't want to just find some patchwork group of words over it. It was a great paradox, a great mystery. How could God die? Mm-hmm. And instead of sort of recognizing this is a mystery that I'm overwhelmed by, you don't just find some verbal formulation that sort of patches it all together.
All right. Well, Dr. McCauley, thank you very much for appearing on Church and State on Magnificat Radio, and hopefully you can be back with us sometime soon. And we know you've written about economics, about usury, and I'm sure you have some thoughts on the presidential race, but we'll get to those at another time. But thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Brian McCall of Oklahoma Law School, we appreciate you coming on, Doctor, and we also want to direct your attention to our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook, Church and State with Stephen Cox. I posted an article there, a link to an article written by Elliot Milko. Elliot works for firstthings.com. It's formerly a neo-Americanist, sort of neoconservative website. It's very ecumenical, but Elliot's come in there, and he's giving kind of a breath of fresh air here. He's arguing that, hey, if you're Catholic and living in the United States, we can't appeal to liberalism and courts to grant us our religious liberty and to recognize our freedom of conscience. We need to recognize that the Americanist project that was supported by folks like John Courtney Murray and others, that it's largely failed. And we need to kind of have a correction in our course direction and convert the country to Christ and to the Catholic truths first. We can't be we need to be Catholics first, essentially, is what Elliot's saying. So go on there and check that out. I think he's someone you want to keep an eye on. So that's it for today's program, folks. Again, reach me at skokx1@gmail.com. Again, this is Church and State on Magnificat Radio, where we are living our traditional Catholic faith. Take care.